Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi, Jason Wilk, founder and CEO of Dave.
Jason, thanks so much for making time to join us on Ivy Podcast. Before we dive into all the great things you're doing with Dave.com, tell us a little bit, give us a thumbnail version of your career prior to that.
Well, thanks for having me, John. I'm a serial entrepreneur. I've been building products since I was a kid, and I've always been running companies since the day I graduated school. Building my first company in my dorm room in college called One Day Sports. I have a real passion for entrepreneurship and building things to help customers. And here I am today.
Well, that's super exciting. Resonates on so many levels as a fellow entrepreneur. I've successfully failed quite a few of my startups. So that definitely resonates. With regards to what are you currently building with Dave.com, just tell us a little bit more about the value proposition and what are you guys building?
Yeah, so we're building products to Dave to help level the financial playing field. We want to give everyone access to a affordable and premium experience within banking that has never happened before. Customers in this country are tired of paying $30 billion of overdraft fees, minimum balance fees, high APR, and we think now is a golden age to really develop an incredible digital experience that customers can really take back ownership of a great financial life and have truly a financial opportunity.
As far as company, when it comes to company growth, and we've seen great emergence of various mechanisms such as SPACs, as alternatives to IPOs and going public. Talk to us a little bit more from that perspective. I understand you have some experience in this space, and what are some of the benefits of perhaps, going the SPAC route in terms of the company growth?
For us, it was somewhat indifferent. We really just wanted access to the public markets and to capital. We were approached by one of the preeminent fintech investors, Tiger Global, that if we were to go public, they would anchor our investment with a $150 million check. And they also were the ones that gave us the valuation. And so the nice part about a SPAC is you can raise effectively a private round of financing at a price that you like, and you can take that into the public markets via a SPAC vehicle. Versus the IPO route is a little more uncertain as to how much capital you're going to raise, what the actual valuation is going to be until the very end. And so we like the certainty of the SPAC route.
So how does that typically work for those that are not closely familiar with that? What are some of the key determinants that really make up for, deciding or choosing the SPAC route, being able to understand that this is a particular valuation that I can get in terms of expectation of that, that open check at the end of the day through the private route? Just talk to us a little bit more from that perspective.
At the end of the day, they're fairly similar processes. I mean, Dave was a little bit unique in that we have not raised a lot of private capital in the history of the business. It had been a while since we had repriced the valuation of the company. And so when you think of a traditional IPO, generally companies have raised quite a bit of capital. They have raised a recent round of financing that gives some kind of validation to where their valuation will end up. And then we both end up really setting on the same path. So we either an IPO or a SPAC, you're both going to talk to dozens of investors to effectively build a relationship with all the eventual funds that will be purchasing your stock once you're a public business. The difference being is really when an IPO, you're going out to sort of make a market, and in a SPAC, you really have made the market with your sponsor and your effectively pipe investors, and then you're just going out and really validating that with investors. So it's just a little bit more backwards with a SPAC, but that backwards approach does give you the certainty of capital and valuation.
I want to shift gears a little bit from a perspective. When we talk about growth, obviously, you know, a lot of the growth is attributed to yours and your leadership team's abilities to surround yourself with the top talent. In this highly competitive markets, this war for talent out there is real. In terms of the strategies or practical recommendations that really help you guys attract the top talent to your organization, just share some strategies from that standpoint.
Well, it starts with the mission. We have to have a mission that really motivates people to want to help level the playing field, help our customers get out of financial distress. There's a lot of people that really want to use their brain power to affect change in that industry that is ripe for disruption, just given how expensive it is. The low to moderate income individuals in this country are paying close to $300 billion a year in bank fees and interest fees. And that equates to something crazy around 13% of their overall take-home pay, which is certainly something that's helping keeping people from achieving success on their own terms. So that's a big part of it, is just the mission in itself. Second is, we really develop products that are easily measurable, that we are helping our customers. And so we keep an impact dashboard. We can actually tell how much money we're saving our members in overdraft fees. And our products in general are innovative and first to market. Our first product is called Extra Cash, and that product helps our members get $100 of free spending power to go buy gas or groceries as an alternative to paying $34 at your bank to go negative on your account. And that innovation has been pretty tremendous. But as far as also how we are developing and building our talent, we were one of the very first companies to go virtual first. And that's been an amazing way for us to help get talent across the country. We have team members in, I think, about 15 states at this point. And it's also helping us just get employees who have worked in the industry before. Being in Los Angeles has been somewhat of a challenge to get amazing fintech talent, given there really is not a lot of banks that have ever been here. So for us, it was a real strategic element, but it's also been welcoming for people to be able to spend more time with their families and et cetera.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And follow-up question on that, are you guys looking to maintain that type of infrastructure to be completely virtual? And moreover, as far as really fostering that culture that, you know, you guys are aiming to build through virtual spaces, adds another layer of complexity. What are your thoughts around that? How do you continue cultivating the culture you set out to build in a completely virtual environment?
It is more challenging, and we've weighed the risks of that. And ultimately, we would rather try and work harder to build the culture digitally than really try and bring everyone back to an office. I think that spending time commuting in a car and spending time trying to get people to move across the country to join your organization is ultimately going to lead to a slower pace of innovation. And that slight trade-off on culture, we didn't think was worth going back to the old ways of working. Technology is certainly good enough now to fully collaborate from anywhere in the world.
When it comes to interviewing, it's a complicating space because a lot of the interviews based on that past personal experience in terms of what are the weaknesses that I can tolerate in that particular candidate versus more emphasis on the strengths that are missing on my team, and can that particular candidate fill that void? Tell us a little bit about your approach to interviewing. How do you structure them, and what do you look for in responses when you hear them?
So there's a great book that is called Who, that talks about interviewing, which I really enjoyed. It gives a lot of focus on hiring scorecards, you know, really trying to figure out who is the really right person for this role. What are the characteristics that this person is going to make up, and really helps you figure out, based on scoring people on those different attributes and characteristics of their experience, is this the right person for the job? So creating good job descriptions and the scorecard have been very effective. And we find that times when we don't use that, we kind of go by our gut, or because this person has a really amazing resume, has actually worked against us in a pretty major way. So we've continuously been going back to this scorecarding methodology. And I think it's really important, because the person that you wouldn't think on paper necessarily is the right person for the job, they oftentimes check a lot of the boxes. And so even if they may not have the most perfect resume, they may actually be the right person for what you're looking for.
Going from private to public organization, does that worry you in terms of the impact it will have on its culture? And how are you preparing your organization for such change?
Yeah, I think that it's going to be a shift. Yeah, we do need to have much more focus, not that we haven't, but more focus on performance of the business. Yeah, I do consistently tell the team that we're not building this company for the short-term stock price. I mean, we are building this for long-term customer value. Company I point to a lot to our group, given they're also an LA company, is Snap, which saw their stock price go all the way down, you know, I think down to $6 or $7 last year. And they also went through some major product changes, but that the Wall Street didn't necessarily like, but at the end of the day, they believed in what they were building. They kept their heads down, focused, and now it's a $120 billion company. I just think that you have to teach the company to ignore the noise, and that's what we're going to do. You know, ultimately, we're in the golden age of a digital revolution of financial technology and banking. And if we do our jobs right, the stock price will follow. But who knows what it'll be in a few months, but it doesn't really matter to me.
What are the different trends and ideas and insights that you personally are very excited about through the next period? What are you researching? What are you tinkering with on nights and weekends?
Just Dave. I mean, that's my 100% focus right now. And so always reading up on new technologies, talking to different companies. I think there's lots of interesting things happening across the board, from companies entering teen banking to crypto to all types of, you know, stable coins. There's so many things going on in finance. It's almost hard to keep track of, but yeah, that's been the hardest part for us is, you know, how do you pick and choose from this wealth of really cool opportunities to build and be really good at it.
With us more or less coming out of pandemic and, you know, in terms of inflation and how just the overall aftermath of COVID will impact the consumer spending behavior and habits, tell us a little bit more about what you're preparing for. What are some of the things that, you know, we should pay attention to?
Well, I think there's just been so much money pumped into the system through stimulus, through unemployment. We're just seeing checking account balances at an all-time high. And we are seeing the impacts of that in terms of the short-term inflation that's happening right now. I think we haven't seen inflation this big in terms of consumer products in the last 30 years. And so I don't necessarily know we've realized what we've necessarily done by putting trillions of dollars into the economy. It's having impacts on products, it's having impacts on, I don't think anyone anticipated people not wanting to go back to work until their checking account balance was back into danger territory. So it's been a really interesting thing to watch over the last few months. And I don't think it's going to get any better necessarily in the near term.
Right. As far as your personal content diet, the sources that you consume on a daily basis to keep yourself informed on everything that goes on in your industry, just share some of those sources with us.
Every day I read Tech Meme. I think that's a really great publication that sort of aggregates all the best and latest tech news from across every publication. It uses algorithms to basically rank top reporters and top news articles, so you don't have to figure out what's the most important news of the day. I probably am on that a few times a day. I read Hacker News, which is always an interesting read. And yeah, sometimes Wall Street Journal, New York Times. I believe that's about it.
As far as career advice or series of advice that you had received early on in your career that you continuously refer back to even these days and share with others, can you think of some of those examples?
Just to be all in on what you're doing. I see a lot of people who they want to be entrepreneurs. They want to try and sort of moonlight it at night. But at the end of the day, you're competing against the best people in the world. And so I've never really been a heavy believer in side projects and things on the side to make sort of, you know, $1,000, $2,000 a month. In reality, if you can make $1,000, $2,000 a month, that's what everybody wants. So most likely that's something that could be making $1 million a month. So I would say, you know, if you really want to be an entrepreneur, you've just got to be 100% dedicated. And now that there's so much venture capital out there, there's really no reason not to dive headfirst and give your dream a chance.
Yeah, that's powerful. And Jason, last but not least, what are you currently reading in terms of books? And what is one book that you always recommend to others? And why is that?
I'm reading the Anthony Bourdain biography right now, which is a pretty interesting read. He was someone I really thought was an incredible tastemaker. And yeah, it was sad to see him pass. So it's really interesting to see this, read this book at this point. Mm-hmm. And as far as something I always recommend reading, question, I don't know. I mean, I tend to like to read just certain autobiographies of successful entrepreneurs. I think the McDonald's book is interesting. I think the founding story of Walmart and the founding story of Virgin is also, those are three really interesting books because these are guys that effectively developed incredible, huge businesses off a very simple idea. To me, that's really, really motivating to have guys at level this, have this much level of success. And the idea in, by no means for any of them was rocket science.
Yeah, I'll add a little bit, I'll add to that. So I'm currently finishing up That Will Never Work, the Netflix story. I thought that was pretty fascinating in terms of just really persevering through, you know, the crazy times, and it kind of goes hand in hand with what you were talking about as far as the advice going all in on things. So that definitely resonates. Jason, I can't thank you enough for the very short and insightful conversation. I wish you best of luck with going public. Definitely keep us posted. What we love doing with all the guests is do a follow-up recording in about a year where we revisit the conversation from a year ago, see if everything we've discussed still makes sense, still applies. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
Okay, great. Nice to meet you, John.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.